Now we come to the next one. Replacement of old method of doing old method by doing work scientifically. Old method was what? It was being in, we were just doing it as a art. It was just being done randomly. Everything was being done, but the time spent was different. The way the process flow was also not in a systematic manner. That was replaced by scientific working. Fair work to each worker. Standardization in work. Differential piece rate of payment system. Now, differential piece rate system is nothing but for different types of jobs that we do, we need to be paid proportionately to the job. We all know that the senior management in companies get paid more than the middle, than the junior. Now, why is this done? Because of the nature of the work. The nature of the work, the nature of the position, the work given to the person would ensure that there is a differential wages, differential piece rate payment. Piece rate meaning if every one unit I make, I get X amount of money, every two will be 2X and so on. So depending upon the piece output that you're giving, you will be getting more or less depending upon more or less production you've done, right? So the income is based on the output that you're giving in a piece rate basis, right? Harmony in group action, peace and friendship and dissatisfaction to be avoided. This is the second thing he talked about. Next, we talk about cooperation between management and workers, easy to understand. There should be give and take, a very democratic and a very participative approach. Maximizing output by division of work, by assumption of responsibility jointly by management and workers. Improvement of workers. This is the next point which highlighted in Taylor's work. Scientific selection of workers, finding out physical, educational and psychological requirements of each job and find suitable persons for each job. The right person for the right job. So we have to look for certain conditions of working on the basis of which we actually hire people who are suiting those conditions. Workers are provided with job training as well. After we join a company, when the induction is over, the orientation is over, or during that time, you are given a training to fit into the job properly. This system was not available long back, but Taylor initiated this. And today we are still following it in practically every organization. Separation of planning from the executive function. Now, planning is more of a function of thinking, using intelligence, etc. Now, that's more of a desk work. It requires elaborate time. It requires a lot of support people. Execution is what? Doing it. Now, there was a time when I planned and I executed. Now, he said that let us separate both of them apart. Let planning be done separately, execution be done separately. Thereby, what happens? You create specialists. The execution person is out of the tension of planning. The planning person is out of the tension of execution. So, both of them are able to use their faculties in a proper manner. Scientific task setting. The tasks have been set in a very systematic manner. How to machine the component, how the first particular cut will be taken, what's the next step. So very scientifically the task is set, the task flow also, the work is also flown in such a manner, right? Look at the production, look at the assembly of any automobile unit. It's a part of the scientific task setting. Everything is flowing through the conveyor and the car gets progressively built up, right? Functional foremanship. That means the foreman is a person who is getting the work done at the shop floor level by the workers, and he has to become a functional person, meaning he should be a person who knows the job, who has worked there, and then he has come to become a foreman, right? Next, we talk about work study, method study, motion study, time study and fatigue study. This is all coming under a particular area of study which is called as industrial engineering today. When somebody is doing a work, I study how he is doing it, which tool he takes first. How does he hold the tool? How many minutes does it take for the piece to be made? So when the various things I do, I study the work that he is doing. I study the methods, the way he is doing it. I study the motions that he is using, body motions. Why is it important? The body motion determines whether you are using your human energy efficiently or otherwise. By doing a motion study, I can determine which motions have to be avoided because they fatigue you, and which motions have to be given more weightage because they actually give you relaxation. Now, it is to this level of deep thinking they went into. And time study. How long does a person take to make their particular component? Does he take 2 minutes, 6 minutes, 8 minutes? Time study. And then finally, fatigue study. when we are working, we get tired, we get fatigued. So is fatigue happening frequently in this job? Is it happening erratically? Is it at all happening? So that study is also done. With this, there are other associated studies that have been a part of industrial engineering, which was not initiated by F.W. Taylor at that point of time, right? Rate setting. Rate setting is nothing but at what rate you need to be paid. What should be the rate of production that is coming out? A standardization of the rate at which things have to be moving. Standardization, this I've already explained. Scientific selection and training, financial incentives, mental revolution. That means mind, I should be able to be a learner. I should go ahead in skills. I should start thinking better day after day. That's mental revolution. And eliminate wastage by maximizing maximum utilization of resources. Right? Now we come to the next gentleman, very celebrated Peter F. Drucker, who is also called as a father of modern scientific management. Father of modern scientific management. Let's see what was his contribution, very significant contribution. Now, Drucker coined the term knowledge worker. Today, this term is used quite extensively. Knowledge worker, and later in his life, considered knowledge worker productivity to be the next frontier of management. He had spoken about it quite some time back. Today we know we are in the information age and the knowledge age, wherein we find that high premium is given to the persons with knowledge, which is nothing but an extensive idea about some subject or some topic in which the person is able to contribute to making things happen. So the day of the knowledge worker was already told by Peter Drucker quite some time back. No bureaucratic management. What is meant by bureaucracy? Things are very systematically done, one after the other. Clear cut, impersonal. The work matters, not the person. But this system is beautiful. It goes very well. But Taylor felt that bureaucratic management is not required. Let the human being, let the human in the person come out. Okay? It's not impersonal. It has to be a little bit personal. Emphasize management with creative and innovative characteristics. Management has to be creative, the art of management. Innovative, which is also the art of management. He emphasized the importance of bringing out the art part of management, allowing people not to be controlled but to be free so that they give better output. That was the philosophy with which he spoke, Peter Drucker, right? Basic objective of management is innovation, that is development of new ideas, combination of old and new ideas, adaptation of ideas from other fields also to encourage others to carry out innovation. It's a whole new thing which we are all going through today. Our course itself, is it not based on the innovation principle? A distance learning hybrid course wherein we have contact programs where you come physically to the institute, the virtual classes which we run at night to reach the subject to you, then we have other value-added activities which we conduct. Now all these put together, is it not one of the things we are doing today? Now this is the managing and educational field by using management principles, as simple as that, right? Now he treated management as a discipline as well as a profession. Discipline means what? It's a type of a subjective, it's an approach which is like a subject. So it has got a syllabus, just like science, physics, chemistry, etc. It's a discipline. It's got certain procedures and certain ways of doing things. At the same time, it's a profession. Meaning, management is required for us. We can become a management professional, a management consultant or a trainer or something like that. Right? So two things. It has got a discipline part of it. It's also got an application in the form of a profession. Right? A manager has to determine the objectives and the activities and is concerned with the direction and controlling of the activities. A manager has to determine the objectives and the activities. He has to determine and is concerned with the direction and the controlling of the activities to make contributions for the specific purpose and the mission of the institution, whether business, hospital or university. So it is he who initiates it, driven by him, right? An effective organization structure is framed in such a way that it enables smooth performance. It contains minimum number of managerial levels. It provides a chance to test the ability of young people who are accepting the responsibility. So he claimed it was important that the organization structure is having minimum number of managerial levels. The levels are nothing but from the top to bottom, there are different levels at which people are working. The DGM level, the GM level, the VP level, you know, different levels are there. Those levels he advocated should be reduced, it should not be too long. See, there was a time we had an organizational structure which was as tall as 12 to 14 to 18 levels. Very long. When it is long, you know what happens? We have a reporting system which is quite tedious and the work gets delayed because of too many people coming on the scalar chain. By reducing the number of levels, you empower the persons to start taking decisions, and the decision making also by itself will take a lesser time because there are lesser people to whom you are reporting. Quickly you get the feedback, quickly you get the direction to act upon it. That's why. Centralization control with the structure of decentralization. This is another thing Peter Drucker advocated. So similar to the federal structure of the government. Federal structure of the government means in USA. They have a system which is different from India, right? Similar to the federal structure of the government, the top management has more powers than the various departments. But the decisions regarding the departments have to be taken by both of them. Departments are allowed to take decisions within the limits set up by the top management. Now this is very nice to understand. Top management will say, you are independent, you do it your way. But when you are doing it your way, we have to get involved. I will give you the independence, at the same time I am keeping a centralized approach. There is a centralized approach in which I am watching you, I am not empowering you, and there is a decentralized approach in which I am empowering you to take your own decisions. Right? Combination of these two things. Now we talk about Peter Drucker and his MBO. Management by objectives was introduced in 1954 by Drucker, and the method of planning, setting standards, performance appraisal and motivation are the components of MBO. The typical approach which we all go through, but MBO is a separate process which needs a systematic way of operating. But it principally it involves these things: planning, setting standards, performance appraisal and motivation. It gives importance to self-control rather than control made by others. The beauty about MBO is that it empowers everybody down the line from top to bottom on a one-to-one basis. On a one-to-one basis, it empowers everybody to achieve their individual goals as well as the organization goals. And most importantly, it says that you have your individual self-control. We don't need others to control you. It empowers the person to become more responsible. His objectives become more clear and he is able to take things further, right? Peter Drucker visualized rapid changes in society due to rapid technological development. He's a very recent management guru. He saw there was a lot of technology galloping ahead. And he said, with that, he said, there will be a lot of changes in society. Not only in industry, but also in society. He realized the impact of such changes on human life. He stressed that human beings should develop an attitude to face the changes by developing dynamics organization and by absorbing the changes, rapid changes. Okay? So now we discuss Frank B. Gilbreth and Mrs. Lillian Gilbreth, husband-wife team. Very interesting thing. Both of them have contributed majorly to the study and practice of management. Let's see what they've done. Let's take Frank Gilbreth first. Frank Gilbreth gave importance to time study and motion study. He was more concerned with finding out the best way to do a job rather than time required to do a job. I repeat, he was more concerned with finding out the best way to do the job rather than the time required to do the job. The time was not the only issue, it is how best we can do it. He stressed minimum motions and avoidance of unnecessary motions to discover the best way of doing a job. Now, what is this all about? Let's try to understand. If you go and read about his background, you'll come to know that he did an experiment at a brick manufacturing unit. A brick manufacturing unit, he did an experiment in Pittsburgh, USA. He noticed that people, brick industry is basically a labor intensive industry. Now, in this labor intensive industry, too many people moving in too many directions, and he saw that there was a lot of leakage of human energy. The time required and the motions that people were going through in terms of movement were totally haywire. there were people who were replicating the activities. There were times when people were actually not doing what they are supposed to do. There were a lot of confusion and chaos. Activity was going on, but effectiveness of the activity was something which needed to be enhanced. So he went along and did the study, and in the study he came to know, he created what is called as Thurblix, which is coming in the next slide. And this is nothing but, he said that it's important for us to know that we must learn to conserve the human energy and by human movements. For example, if there's a load kept in the floor right now, here, now I can bend my whole body and pick up the load, or I can sit and pick up the load. Now, between the two, which is a much more comfortable thing for my body, bending is more uncomfortable than sitting and picking it up. So certain types of body motions we need to do, and which will make us comfortable, which will make us a little less stressed, is what Thurblix is all about. So he stressed minimum motions and avoidance of unnecessary motions to discover the best way of doing a job. When I do unnecessary motions, what happens to my body? It starts getting tired very fast. When it gets tired very fast, my productivity comes down, my motivation also comes down. The purpose of his study was to ensure that the motivation levels are high. To keep the motivation levels high, the body had to be as fresh as possible, as energetic as possible. And to make that thing happen, he studied on the motion of the human body, the worker, and the time which it took. So that is why it is called as a time and motion study. Time study and motion study. Okay. Now, he identified 18 basic elements in work through analysis of several methods at work by using flow process charts. He called these elements as Thurblix. If you see Thurblix is a, if you see G, if you spell it backwards, G-I-L-B-E-B-R-E-T-H-B-H-T, it's called as, it's nothing but Gilbreth. His name is jumbled to give a term called Thurblix with an S added. Okay. Now, which are, what are these, let's say 18 basic elements? They are like an icon. They are like a small picture. Just as we have emoticons in the mobile phones, there were icons which depicted search, an activity, select another activity, grasp, transport, empty, transport loaded, hold, release load, position, pre-position, inspect, assemble, disassemble, use, wait, unavoidable, avoidable, delay, plan, rest for overcoming fatigue, find. You need to remember all the 18 in that order. They were basically telling the worker what they are supposed to do at a certain location in the plant. Okay, so that there was no confusion about it. And by doing this, duplication of work, multiplication of work was completely or eliminated or avoided to the minimum. Right? So that is a contribution which Frank Gilbreth had to the study and practice of management. The productivity at the plant was higher because he did a time and motion study and reset people's motions in such a way that they were able to give a better output. Now comes his wife, Lillian Gilbreth. She was a psychologist and she preached the message of her husband after his death. She was a psychologist and had a thorough knowledge of human relations. She got a doctorate degree for her work, The Psychology of Management, and she was awarded the degree of the first ambassador of management in 1960. Now we come to Max Weber. Max Weber, a German. He framed rigid rules to eliminate managerial inconsistencies which led to ineffectiveness. Now, what is managerial inconsistency? When I'm working on a certain goal, there is a tendency for my human side of it to come out, and this human side of it is important, it is not unimportant. But this human side at times interferes with the process laid down by the organization. For example, I'm supposed to service a client, let us say in 4 minutes as per the process chart. I'm giving an example, okay? I'm supposed to service a client in 4 minutes as per the process chart. If it is less than 4 minutes, it can go up to 3 minutes minimum, but it can't go less than that. Otherwise, the service quality will suffer. I may service the client for 1 minute extra. That is, instead of 4, I can make it 5 minutes. So there's a service tolerance of 3 minutes to five minutes, with 4 being the average. Now, on a particular day, I'm a little fatigued. I feel a little bored. And so what I do is, instead of servicing him at 4 minutes or 5 minutes or 3 minutes, it goes up or down. So I may be you, and my human element will come and interfere into my discipline. It's bound to happen, right? Now, these inconsistencies are common to all human beings everywhere. It's like, you know, when you come back from lunch, your output at the workplace slightly reduces, sometimes considerably. So the human inconsistency comes and interferes with the work. That's why we have to learn to have a variety of work wherein our output is not reduced. And so what did he do? He framed rigid rules to eliminate managerial inconsistencies, which led to ineffectiveness. He emphasized strict adherence of rules and regulations in an organization. He said, if it is 4 minutes, I'm giving this example, if it's 4 minutes, 4 minutes it shall be. Whatever happens, ensure that this is taken care of. And to create this, he formed an organization called a bureaucracy. This term is very popular, we all know it. Bureaucracy is a system of checks and controls wherein the job is impersonal. It's not personal, it is impersonal, meaning the work matters, who does it is unimportant. It is not person oriented, it is work oriented. There are clear cut boundaries of work which flow from top to bottom. And at every workstation, there is a system of checks and controls so that the work is going systematically in line with the goals. The work allocation is such that the work has to be done no matter what. Human interference is kept to the minimum. If X is having his managerial inconsistency coming into the picture and it continues for too much of a time, then he is replaced by another person, which means the productivity is important. And to make the productivity happen, a set of processes which are very, very clear cut, watertight compartments were created, called as bureaucracy, right? And he said that bureaucracy is the best form of organization and is suitable for any nature of business, because it creates scope for proper channelization of human energy and mechanical energy. Now, there are two views to this. One view says that bureaucracy is very oppressive. Bureaucracy is to do with the job, not with the person. So the person loses his importance. And when the person loses his importance, it's likelihood that he may get into all sorts of other negative activities. Because every person relates his own life with the work that he does. Now, if you say that it doesn't matter whether you're there or not, because the work matters, then the person will feel, what am I doing here? One view. The other view says, a person should not get emotional about the work that he's doing. He must do the work in the best of the abilities and then be done with it. Because at the end of the day, the work has to be done. What comes to the person does not matter. He need not feel emotional about it. Now, both the views are right in their own way. One is not right, the other one is not wrong. Both are equally right in the context in which it is used. Bureaucracy is used in many, many countries, practically all countries, I would say, wherein the decision-making process is very complex for a certain goal, which is very, very crucial. Like when we talk about the armed forces, Army, Navy and Air Force in any country, and they are buying, you know, ships or aircraft or maybe some tanks, it's a matter of security of hundreds and thousands of people, the citizens of that country. So to make those decisions happen, we need to have proper amount of checks and controls wherein decisions are not taken emotionally, they have to be taken very, very methodically, technically. So these decisions, to enable them to happen properly, we need to have a system similar to the bureaucracy. In fact, bureaucracy is what is used in these scenarios. Wherever there is a crucial aspect of life and limb and safety of a large group of people, or the efficient running of a whole country itself, we need to have a bureaucracy. Bureaucracy, by far, I would say, is one of the best systems, provided people are responsible, self-responsible. The moment I come and talk to you with a certain amount of commitment towards the work, and I really do a good job and I convey to you, I think it matters a lot. unless and until I feel emotional that no, I should be rewarded, I should be doing this, I should be doing that. In fact, bureaucracy, I would say, is a bit of a detached way of working with their work. But that's easily said than done, because all of us are attached to whatever we do. Bureaucracy has not been so very favored in many countries only because it has other types of problems. Okay, in a bureaucracy, things go in a very systematic manner. The person doesn't matter, the work matters. Work flows from A, the senior most person, to B, to C, to D. And when the work flows, if B is not there, the work gets delayed. Then that leads to certain other complexities. Bureaucracy leads to red tapeism, they say. Red tapeism means things go slowly because of some delay in between when they're checking and controlling certain aspects, certain facts about the particular goal that is need to be attained. So there are several things. At the same time, I would still say that there are countries where bureaucracy works very well. In the corporate world, bureaucracy works. In all the public sector undertakings, you find bureaucracy way of working. Now, how it works well or not well depends upon how well and what sort of people with what intentions are running it. So, unfortunately, bureaucracy has got a bad name in many places because people use bureaucracy inappropriately for their own personal gains, using their position of power. Okay, so that's about bureaucracy. And now we go to Mary Parker Follett. This lady was a behavioral science expert. Behavior science is an interdisciplinary approach towards understanding behavior. Lots of inputs are there. It's got a lot to do with the complexity of the human mind, about the social aspect of the person, about the political science part of behavior. So many things are taken as inputs. Anthropology. So many disciplines are brought together and behavior is studied and understood. Right? Now, what did she do? She spoke about conflict. She rejected domination and compromise ways of removing conflict. Under integration, the wishes of both the parties are integrated. So she said that if there's a conflict at the workplace, there are two ways of handling a conflict conventionally. I browbeat you into saying that you're wrong and I'm right, and somehow I make you do the work. From the position of power, the conflict can be handled in a very aggressive way by putting down the other person. I am right and you're wrong. The other way would be that one would subjugate to what is being told from the bottom, from the juniors to the seniors. For example, it can happen in companies where the unions are very strong, they may bully the management. So when we are talking about conflicts, the conflicts usually get resolved in a negative way either ways. Now here she talked about the importance of integration of both the parties. What you get, you should get. What I get, I should get. So we come at a meeting point and have this thing happen, right? So both the parties will be satisfied without sacrificing their desires. A smooth employer and employee relationship based on cooperation is the foundation of good industrial organization, according to Mary Parker Follett. Then she talked about leadership. Leaders are not only born but also could be made through proper training in human behavior. She did not believe in dominating leadership. Being a psychologist, she gave a lot of emphasis to the human mind and the human psyche. She said if you treat the human psychology properly, by a lot of understanding, give and take, without dominating, things would be much, much better. Leaders would be able to influence their employees, their followers to go higher if they are a little bit participative and they are making things happen in a much more defined way rather than just dominating and getting aggressive and autocratic, right? And now we talk about the next person, next contributor, whose name is Henry L. Gantt, famously known for his Gantt chart and the Gantt plan. Now he understood the importance of trade union and introduced a new incentive wage plan, Gantt task and bonus plan. He's known for this. Gantt was the founder of a new movement known as a new machine. This term is very important for you to remember, the new machine. What is this new machine? It's not just a machine. It avoids the exercise of power and advocated harmonious relationships between employers and employees. A system by which the work carries on. And when the work is carrying on, it does not disrupt the relation between you and me, the employer and the employee. So this sort of a system was produced by him, wherein he said that we have to exercise the exercise of power has to be minimum and we must create more of harmonious relationship between employers and employees. If you now, as you're listening to me, you can realize how gradually the various contributors so far whom I've discussed gradually brought the thought process from simply into production, from production into human related production. So the human being was given slowly, slowly more importance. The human comfort, the harmony, etc. was given by importance by many of these contributors who came in later after Henry Fayol and F.W. Taylor and other people in the earlier days, right? So it is a perceptible shift from only production oriented behavior into a human oriented related production, which matters a lot today, as you know, right? Gantt is popularly known by his Gantt chart, referred to the progress of work. Now this is a little, Gantt chart is all about, in a production center there are a number of components we are making and there are quantities also very high and it needs to be done in a fast speed, higher speed output. So there are a number of machines, number of workstations. So when all these things is there, it could become very complex. In a nutshell, if I can explain to you what is Gantt chart is basically telling us how a number of components in numbers, in huge numbers, can be made at a workstation by doing what is called as machine scheduling. The man and the machine who are together to make a component, there have to be some study done so that the work goes smoothly without any interruption. I am not getting into the details of it because I wanted to learn what it is. In short, Gantt chart is just telling us that how to ensure that there is uninterrupted flow of production so that there is no loss either to the machine idle time or to the man idle time and the productivity goes on. That's Gantt chart. Okay? And Gantt considered the psychological and the social needs of workers. He said that people don't work for the company alone. They are having their own psychological needs and comforts which they want to attain. They also have a social need of connecting to each other at the workplace and with others. This is what was Henry Gantt's contribution in short. Now we come to George Elton Mayo. He was the first person to look into the matter of human relations, emphasizing the importance of desires, attitudes and feelings of the workers. Let's remember that the second industrial movement, industrial revolution took place under the circumstances where there was a lot of panic and scarcity. Now when there's a panic and scarcity, our entire energies are diverted into production, more into what needs to be done rather than how I feel when I'm doing what needs to be done. I'll repeat. When there's a crisis, our focus is on what needs to be done, not on how I feel about what needs to be done. Correct? So my feelings don't matter. The human being doesn't matter, but the output matters. That was the type of tone, that was the type of mood that prevailed those days when we started. Now George Elton Mayo, he said, it's not enough to talk about production alone. What about the human beings who are actually working there? Do they matter or not? Do they have proper comfort? And so many other questions he started raising to himself with a team. And he said there is an importance to validate desires of the employees, the attitudes, the feelings of the people who are working there. And he, along with his colleagues, conducted Hawthorne experiment, the famous Hawthorne experiments, an important landmark in the history of the human relations movement. Let's see what it is. Hawthorne experiments were conducted at the Hawthorne plant of the Western Electric Company in Chicago, US from 1924 to 1932. It was done by Elton Mayo and his colleagues and were published in six volumes. In six volumes they were published. Very extensive research done, which led to a lot of revelations about how the people feel at the workplace, what sort of output they can, how they can increase the output, what drives them to work, what drives them not to work. So those things came up as a very, very intensive study. So the six volumes are the human problems of industrial civilization, the social problems of industrial civilization, the industrial worker, separate volume on written on the industrial worker alone, leadership in a free society, management and worker, management and morale. Okay. Now Elton Mayo and his colleagues conducted researches in four phases in this plant. The illumination experiments, relay assembly test room experiment, mass interviewing program, bank wiring observation room experiments. What are they? In a nutshell, I'll tell you. He saw some girls at the factory where they were making electric bulbs. She saw them working there. And these girls who were working at the electric bulb manufacturing unit at Western Electric, they were assembling the bulbs manually. And there was a certain type of a process flow that they had created. He and his colleagues felt that this particular area, I think the illumination should be better. If there's a better lighting condition, they may do it well. Today it is common knowledge to us. Today we know that the working conditions have to be good. This room where I'm talking to you is a very well lit room. It's comfortably air conditioned. So I'm feeling comfortable. Now, this is common knowledge today, but that wasn't thought of those days. Why? Because the emphasis was on production, not on the human element. So he saw these things going on and he said that I think if the lighting conditions improve, they might be offering better productivity. So the management said, okay, fine, take a control area in the plant and do your experiments. So he went along and did a series of experiments wherein he was trying to correlate the lighting conditions, the motivation of the lady workers and the output which they are giving. He did a lot of trial and error type of experiments. He varied the break times. He increased the break times, he decreased it. He varied the output timings. So many things he kept on varying, and he tried to do all sorts of permutation combination. The initial set of experiments did not yield results. But as he went on refining his methods based on observations and feedback, he came to establish that there is a direct correlation between the lighting conditions, which can be today extended as working conditions. So he said lighting conditions, the worker motivation and the productivity, all of them are linked. Today it is common knowledge. When we talk about motivation programs, we say what sort of company interior you have, is the ambience very conducive, are you having comfortable sitting arrangement, are you having proper ventilation. These conditions do matter. They are called as the hygiene factors. They do matter today, right? So he established, for the first time somebody spoke about the need of the human comfort, the need for human beings to feel in harmony with the surroundings, liking to work in the surroundings. So when they like to work in the surroundings, what happens? Automatically they start feeling good about themselves, their needs are satisfied. And then they feel validated and they will give higher output even without you telling them to do it. The purpose of the experiment was not to do any social service. The purpose of the experiment was to see that how I can increase the output of the workers, and thereby I could pay them more money. So what are the things that can come into picture? So he took this direction of the lighting aspect, and from there he derived this particular output, right? So what are the findings of the Hawthorne experiments? Social factors are responsible for deciding the level of output. Social factors meaning within the company, what sort of social conditions prevail? Are people harmonious with each other? Is the management labor harmonious with each other? Do people socialize, or are they only work oriented? So human beings need breaks. They need to talk to each other. There are times when you don't feel like keep on working. You need to have a break. Those are the social aspects we're talking about. Then the group behavior can influence the individual behavior. If the group is having a type of a friendliness, then the individual also turns to be friendly. When we discuss behavior as a subject, we come across people who talk about the social influence of behavior. Imagine yourself alone, you have a behavior X, but when you're in a social group, your behavior will be Y, different from X. Why? Because the group starts influencing you, right? That is the second thing we talk about. Third is production level is determined by social norms, not by physiological capacities. That means, what are the type of conditions I am creating within the production unit? That is called as the social norms within the plant. Those social norms, once it is set, that is the norm that creates the production level. The better the social norms, the higher is the production, right? There is no direct relationship between production level and the working conditions. Meaning thereby, what really happens is, it is not enough to have only good working conditions alone. As I told you earlier, But what is important is these working conditions has also to be mixed and matched with the social conditions within the company. We come across organizations where we visit, where we find that the company is extremely well, the decor is very good inside, everything is good. But the people are unhappy because inside there's a lot of toxic social energy. It's not very good enough. People are not very comfortable with each other. There is groupism and lots of negative energy. Now, the working conditions around is a precondition, of course, but that alone will not take care of it. There are times when the working conditions are not very clear and clean, yet there's a lot of group synergy. So what is the emphasis? The emphasis is on the social aspect of the working place. But for the social aspect of the working place to be constant, to be good, what do we need to have? We need to have a working conditions as a prerequisite. Working conditions, if they are good, then the social aspect is compounded. It increases, it becomes better. But again, it is not the necessary and the sufficient conditions. It is not important to have only working conditions and then you can say that everything will be okay. No. Working conditions are prerequisite. If it happens, well and good. If it doesn't happen, yet we can have people who will still be socially connected. Okay? So, we take it further. Workers are not motivated merely by money. This is common knowledge today. If money is the greatest motivator, as many people believe, then why would people leave certain types of industries which are paying well? Why is attrition so high? Because money alone doesn't motivate. There are other needs which human beings go through. If those needs are not fulfilled, beyond a point, money doesn't motivate people, simply leave the company and go. Okay? The conflict arises since the objectives of management differ from the objectives of the workers. Now, this is very interesting. Company wants profits. People are willing to give profits, but they say, allow us to stay connected with each other in the company. Very, very tyrannical managements. Management with a very authoritative, very autocratic. They somehow make it a point to see that people don't come together within the company. They don't allow bonding to happen. They divide and rule. They don't allow informal groups to come together. Informal groups are who? Informal groups are the ones who form themselves on their own based on shared values, based on common interests. It automatically happens. Company doesn't have to make an informal group. The organization is a formal group made by the company. Like you cannot choose your senior, can you? No, you cannot choose your peer. You cannot choose your subordinate either, right? But when you go and work in an organization, automatically you will find that with certain people you start vibing within a day or two. And then you start creating your own informal groups. Now those informal groups are a sufficient oxygen required for every employee. You cannot break them. Because those informal groups help the employee to vent himself and be his normal self during the times when he wants to be relaxed. Isn't it true that when you're sitting with your informal groups, you communicate freely, it's like a stress buster, you can talk anything, right? But other times when you're working together with your colleagues, you may not be informal, you have to be formal. Now, organization need says, I want output, so be formal. Employee need says, I will give you the output, but allow me to be informal also. Now, these two needs may clash. So they may set some rules, but the employees may not follow. Culture at the top, climate at the bottom. This can happen. Now this has to be understood by people and this has to be properly addressed. Next comes leadership. Leadership is important for directing group behavior. If I want to influence people towards a certain direction, I need to have a strong leadership. A superior is accepted as a leader if his style is in accordance with the human relations approach and his identification with the group objectives. People would follow me, they would get influenced by me, provided they see what is called as a law of identification. If something is useful to me, I connect with that. So if I am able to create that type of an influencing feeling in people, then they would automatically come and buy in into whatever I am trying to make them do with me. Right? The friendliness and the genuineness of the supervisor helps to maintain productivity. You've got to be genuine. People are friendly as a strategy. I've seen in many places. To get work done, I try to be very friendly with you. I try to talk nice things to you. And then I'm not genuine either. You come to know at the most critical milestone. When the reward has to be given to you, my strategy suddenly turns and I start talking rules and policies. Why can't I be a little more friendly and genuine. If it is not possible, can I tell you upfront in the beginning that, look, it's not possible? You may feel disappointed initially, but you know that you're dealing with a person who's genuine and friendly. Genuine and friendly is not about sweet, sweet talk. It's about making the person realize that this is the reality about where we guys are working. So that when people know that you're talking reality all the time, they are in a position to appreciate when the rewards come or do not come. They know that he's a person who's reliable and trustworthy. It's important, right? Communication is an important part of the organization. We all know it. Complaints and criticism by workers are symptoms of deeper satisfaction. Okay. Now, when people are having complaints and criticism, it means that people are, they like to work there, but they would like to have better things to do. After all, complaints and criticisms comes not because somebody hates somebody. Now, this is one positive aspect one has to look at it. When I have a sense of belonging with a unit to which I belong, where I'm working, then I feel like telling them things where I think there's a scope for improvement. Unfortunately, what happens is cultures suppress criticism, cultures suppress complaints, and even if criticism and complaints come, they don't address it. People feel indifferent and they say they'll stop complaining and criticizing. And then somebody will come and complain once very vociferously, and then the management may say, nobody has complained, how come you are complaining? They do not realize that people have stopped complaining, that is why there are no complaints. Now, it's important to know that complaints and criticisms are useful inputs for the management to know where they are going wrong or right. Instead of quashing it, it is good to allow the complaints and criticism to come and learn from it and improve upon themselves. Now, this is something that needs to be done. Progressive managements do it. Okay, friends? And now, with that, I say thank you to you for listening to me and wish you all the best.